My name is Dan Cantlin. I'm the Director of Research and Evaluation for Cure Violence, formerly known as Ceasefire Chicago. We're still known as Ceasefire Chicago in Chicago, kind of branded that, but switched to kind of focus more on our health approach. So sometimes I may lapse into and say Ceasefire, I'm referring to the same thing. So I want to start out today, the way we look at it is violence is a contagious process. The objective of my presentation is to demonstrate how violence can be viewed as a contagious process, like others, cholera, TB, AIDS, Ebola. And then once we look at it through this health lens, it's kind of a new diagnosis and we're open to new approaches. So if it is an epidemic, then we could use disease control approaches that have been found to be effective. And I also want to quickly discuss the implications of this health lens and kind of where we go from here with new opportunities in combating violence. Can everyone hear me? Okay. Kind of this big barren room with this microphone. I don't know. So the reason I say it can be viewed as a contagious process because it displays the three characteristics of contagious diseases: clustering, epidemic waves, also known as like spread, and then transmission. So if you look at this map, it kind of speaks for itself. These look, very similar, right? One's cholera in Bangladesh, and then we have homicides in Chicago, 2010. And so I think that this slide just kind of speaks for itself, but it's a little misleading because the concentration is much more. I mean, at least I can speak to Chicago. I don't know Bangladesh that well. But in Chicago, I mean, it really is the west and the south sides, and this kind of makes it look like it's even more spread than it is. It's much more concentrated if you look at it from a different map. And this next slide shows the epidemic waves. We have homicide in the United States, and then, down below we have influenza deaths from 1957 to 1958. Eerily similar. If we look at like homicides and shootings, or just the violent crime rate, I think if we take this approach where you look at it as an epidemic as a wave upon wave upon wave, and what I mean by that is you have new susceptible populations. Sometimes things in the environment change. So as homicides go up here towards probably like the 80s and early 90s, you could see before the decline. There's obviously factors such as crack, semi-automatic handguns. But we've had a hard time explaining the rises and falls in homicides. And I think partly is because we're not completely understanding kind of this wave pattern and trying to identify like one main structural force like the economy or changes in policing, or it's because of this or it's because of that, when obviously we know it's more complex and that there could be this kind of disease approach to it where it has these waves that kind of interact with these other factors. And finally, transmission. And so here we have transmission. Exposure to TB can lead to disease of TB. Same as violence, and just the simple fact here that what we're talking about is exposure. That's the common mechanism here, that it passes from one person to another, just like TB. Then we go to this next slide. It not only does it pass from one person to another, but it's also dose dependent. As we show here, low exposure, intermediate exposure, and high exposure. It's not a perfect one-to-one relationship, but as exposure increases, so does violence, either being a victim of a different type of violence or committing a violent act. So in this way, exposure to community violence, which is mainly kind of what we deal with at Cure Violence, although that's not entirely true, but exposure to community violence can lead to more community violence, but can also lead to family violence, other forms of violence like suicide. And we know, we can look at these transmission across syndromes. I mean, we kind of all know that the violence is correlated. In the last session, they were talking about connecting the dots publication. That one form of violence is linked to another form of violence in terms of increased rates and victimization. So intimate partner violence, child abuse, spouse abuse, community violence. you know, we mainly deal with community violence at Cure Violence, in that we're working in poor urban neighborhoods generally, but a large percentage is traced back to other forms of violence. A lot of, you know, intimate partner violence, a lot of domestic and family issues wind up, you know, we see it just as community violence, and it may even be reported as gang violence, but it starts out from, you know, someone's mom being abused by a partner, and then the son's like 18, and then takes, you know, retaliation against him, and then his gang gets involved, and then gangs are involved, and it's just reported as a gang shooting. But really what's underlying this is it all started from an incident of intimate partner violence. And so while we all know that, you know, it's correlated with other forms of violence, also, you know, exposure doesn't mean you're going to become violent or become another victim of violence. You know, most of the time, exposure doesn't lead to any type of disease, or it's subclinical, as we see here. And this is just the same case with other contagious processes. If it was always transmitted, it would be a lot more obvious, and diseases don't work that way. So here you can see, you know, the large percentage of people are pre- or subclinical, or it doesn't lead to any type of violence or further violence. It doesn't mean they're still not impacted by it with trauma and so forth. But, you know, you have other states of, you know, morbidity, mortality, death. You know, what we see a lot with our clients that we work with and engage them in long-term behavior change is relapse. And that's how we view it as we go through the process working with our clients. Because every day, you know, kind of like a drug addict or an alcoholic, every day they walk out in their neighborhood and they're surrounded really by triggers of how they get back involved with it. Whether it's just being on their block in Chicago, because that means you're part of that gang and everyone's targeting you in that way, or hanging out with your friends. So we view it as a relapse. Means of transmission. So just to, you know, draw some more parallels here. This is for the stomach flu, and the means is oral, right? Food, water, hands. We kind of all know that this is how the flu is acquired. As it goes through, you know, comes through orally, it's processed and can result in disease. And just like violence, there's modulating factors. Here the list is age, prior immunity, type of exposure, dose, context, and others. So in terms of violence, the transmission, you know, we see it visually through observing or witnessing violence. Other times, just through direct trauma and direct experience of violence. And so that's the means of acquiring violence. And the processing, as trying to show here, is in the brain, as we're coming to start to understand more and more. Through functional MRIs, brain imaging, some of these things are showing up as we move forward. So this is a slide we'd like to show. You know, really just kind of looking at modeling and visual cues and, you know, how important they are and we don't realize. Although, I don't know why we show this one because it looks like it's 1950. but it reminds me, I was just on Facebook last night and I saw the children see, children do. I don't know if anyone's seen that PubEd advertisement where it shows children watching like their parents yelling at people, becoming violent, smoking. These are, you know, just enormous influences on our behavior. And here, another 1950 slide. but, you know, for this one, I think one of the things we like to highlight is that with some of the functional brain imaging, when you're ostracized from the group through experiments, it shows up as physical pain. And so exclusion can be a big factor in becoming violent and acting violent. So here, if you know you want to avoid exclusion from the crowd, you know, it can result in violence or a fight that didn't need to be a fight that nowadays would lead to possibly a shooting. So when I talk about it too, just kind of want to emphasize that it doesn't mean, you know, when we draw this parallel and say it is a contagious process, obviously that there are other conditions. We're not negating anything else. Some people are more violent than others, as we know. There are other, you know, other factors that result in violence. And, you know, there's roles of trauma and how that impacts people and how they uptake violence and how they experience it, whether it's hyperarousal, PTSD. And then we don't have any slides here, but I think, you know, the field of social psychology, we really incorporate a lot of different things into the way we do our intervention. You know, that has huge implications. And that's just more about the context. That's not about any individual level predisposition. So some of the things, are got the 5 minutes, 5 minutes left? Okay. So some of those would be obedience to authority, diffusion of responsibility, and the bystander intervention. So hopefully, I mean, kind of go through quickly, but I think a strong argument can be made that violence should be seen as a contagious disease or process. And as I started out, you know, mainly by displaying the three main characteristics of clustering, spread, and transmission. Now, to get a much more technical version of this talk and probably more eloquent, Gary Slutkin, the director of Cure Violence, developer of Cure Violence, there's a workshop summary on the contagion of violence through the Institute of Medicine that's available that goes into a lot more detail than quickly what I went into. So, but one of the biggest things is if we change to a health lens, you know, if we look at it this way, that it is an epidemic, a disease, a process that's contagious, it opens up a whole new opportunity of how we stop epidemics. And this has been proven over a number of different diseases. Interrupt transmission, prevent future spread, change group and community norms. And these are the three components of the Cure Violence Health and Epidemic Control Model. And so what do we mean by interrupt transmission, prevent future spread? You know, interrupt transmission is really detect and interrupt. Prevent future spread is behavior change with the highest risk, and then changing community groups and norms. So I'm going to go through these quickly as well. Be happy to talk to people after. Interrupt transmission, we have violence interrupters, just dedicated to knowing the community, going out, getting to know the conflicts before they start or escalate to violence, and they mediate with street gangs, groups, and between individuals. So a good example is the people we hire for this role and then extensively train are known by the community. So they get texts, they get phone calls about something that went down the night before, some drama that's going to be violent. And so they'll get a call and they go out to mediate before it happens. We have a major hospital component most people don't know about. In Chicago, we saw over 1,700 people last year. And this is a great opportunity. Presentation before was calling it, you know, the golden hour of interruption. When someone's shot, we're preventing retaliation right there and trying to, you know, help recovery and then connect them to a ceasefire site. Of course, like 60 to 70% of the people we see in Chicago aren't in a ceasefire neighborhood or cure violence neighborhood. Change behavior, that's more long-term work, kind of case management with people we identify as high risk. And our high-risk characteristics are extremely high risk, not just being a member of a gang, but being a shooter or shot caller of a gang. And then kind of the community component, multiple messengers, shooting responses, pub ed efforts, because it's not enough. The main difference between us is we start where it's hottest, right? We go to the heart of the epidemic and then work our way out. Kind of the opposite of most community-based violence prevention programs. We do work with coalitions and so forth and community level, but until we stop the shooting, you know, it's kind of our theory of change that we need to stop the shooting first and then work on that. And three independent evaluations that have shown positive effects. Not in every neighborhood. We still need to build the evidence base, but in three different cities, Chicago, Baltimore, last one was New York City. We have international sites, a London Youth Detention Center, Cape Town. And then we're going up to scale right now, so just kind of want to highlight that. We almost have as many programs in New York City and New York that we do in Chicago. International settings, we're really targeting Central America. As you can see from this map, we need to get out west. And then here are some of just our international partners, adaptation partners, exploring, and past programs. And so here we, you know, one of our big things, we need to see it through a health lens, and kind of like the health sector needs to take ownership more of violence. How can violence not be a health issue? I mean, there's chronic issues, there's mortality. I mean, it's the biggest contributor to death for African American males, 15 to 24, second for Latino males. And so, you know, our whole contention is that, you know, we need to take a different approach with different strategies guided by the health sector. And that's it. Thank you.